Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest today is quite literally an old friend, which is that it's not he's old, he's an old friend. We've known each other a long, long time, though we are both still in the springtime of our,
of course,
of our years.
You've known each other through different states.
That's right. We've lived in both on both coasts.
Different coasts, different wives, all kinds of adventures.
All of that is true. I'm talking about Jerry Beck. And if you don't know Jerry Beck by name instantaneously, you're probably not into animation in a serious way. Because if you are a fan, a buff, an aficionado of animation, especially classic animation, but all animation, then you sort of have to know Jerry. Well, yeah, it's true. Jerry, talk about your current whereabouts online.
Well, I do a blog that I'm very proud of called cartoonresearch.com. And this is the blog, as my labor of love blog. It's history of animation, a new article every single day, usually written by a whole team of contributors. None of us get paid. This is not for money. It's just out of love, labor of love. So cartoonresearch.com, check it out. We've been doing it in the format. We're doing it now for at least 7 or 8 years. And we have hundreds and hundreds of articles. I'm very proud of that. The other blog I officiate is called Animation Scoop, and you can come see me there. And there we post all the latest news of some sort, one way or another. If there's a brand new revival of Ren and Stimpy or something like that, we'll have
or the new announcement about Guillermo del Toro's trilogy.
Yes, got that email this morning.
Yes, all that sort of stuff, all the press releases, all the, you know, unfortunately, when people pass, and we do reviews of occasional on feature films and things like that. But that's kind of my contemporary, talking about what's going on now.
Right. Yeah. Right. And you also have a longtime affiliation with ASIFA.
Yes.
Yes.
Or ASIFA Hollywood, as it's called.
ASIFA Hollywood is the L.A. branch of the international organization, ASIFA, which is a group that was started in France, in the 50s, late 50s, I believe. We do the Annie Awards. That's our big thing here. We give out we're like the Oscars for animation. You know,
it's very meaningful for everybody in that community. It's a big deal. It's also a lovely event because everybody gets to see each other. So just like any of these other award shows, people sort of care less about the awarding and more about getting to see their buddies or their heroes. And it's lovely. And the animation community in general is quite tight knit. It's something that people are passionate about and deeply passionate about. And I think it definitely makes sense. So as a kid, you don't know how old someone is, how long your parents have been friends with them, whatever. For me, there's always been a Jerry. I don't think there's ever been a point in my life without a Jerry, but I didn't realize how young you both were when you met.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I didn't realize that. I don't even realize it either, because Mice and Magic came out, I guess I was 25. You were 30, because I remember going to your party, your big party, your 30th birthday party. That's when that book came out.
Well, that book is 40 years old, but we met each other even before that.
You met about 5 years earlier than that, at least.
Right. When I started teaching a course on the history of animation at the New School for Social Research in Manhattan. And I graduated from NYU in 1972, so that's how I'm tracing this. And I think I started teaching that course a year later, in 73.
It's something like that. My mom remembers you all.
Yeah.
So that also gives us a gauge of time.
But I started teaching before I met your mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I was definitely, I have the date. I can go look it up. I have, I had to meet Leonard Maltin, and I came to that class with both the Disney films and the Great Movie Shorts, and I had you autograph it. And one of them, you actually dated it. So that's actually the day we met.
Oh, so wow.
Well, it was kismet, bashert. It was meant to be.
Yeah.
That we would meet and become fast friends and long-term friends because we're both unabashedly enthusiastic about the things we love, not just animation, but, it begins with animated cartoons.
It begins with animation, but it ends with Lyle Talbot.
That's true. That's true.
I don't know what that means.
No, it's the book you two write together someday. Right.
Yeah.
Sitting by your projectors, smelling of vinegar.
I just took my 16mm. I have two of them, and I took one of them out, and it's my one from childhood, from my teenage years, and it doesn't work anymore. I mean, I guess I can get it fixed, but it's
by
stopped
whom?
Working.
What? By whom?
Yeah. I don't know.
By whom?
I don't know. But I do have another projector that works. So
do you remember when your light broke? The bulb. The bulb went out, and I said to my dad,
"This is the projection bulb,
right?
That is without which there is no picture,
no.
Right?
Emanating from the projector onto the screen."
So the light goes out, and I said to my dad, "Well, when's the last time you changed it?" And he looked at me. He said, "1965. I don't know.
Those bulbs last forever. I can't figure that out. And even more than that is the immortal exciter lamp."
Oh, yes.
That's right. Yes.
That never goes out.
But that was an adventure. I had to find the bulb, which was still in the same box. Like when they arrived, they were clearly also from 1960, whatever it was, had never been touched because no one needs to replace them, apparently. And getting it in, it was an adventure. But this reminded me again why you have the friends you do, because you can all talk to each other about this stuff.
I hope we don't get into overly sentimental memories, but they are vivid to guys like Jerry and me because we grew up being able to watch old cartoons every day on local television, and I don't just mean old Looney Tunes or old Disney cartoons on Walt Disney's weekly TV show, but I mean old cartoons from obscure studios. Some of which, many listeners will not have heard of. Terry Toons, Van Buren Studios, Iwerks Studios, Charles Mintz Studios. They were all playing on local New York television.
Not only that, I remember silent cartoons. I mean, it was insane how we grew up with the history of animation just being shown to us.
Except that there was no place to find anything about them.
Right.
Right.
You go to the library and there was one book that wasn't very...
Which one do you mean? Because I'm thinking my one book at the time was, it wasn't about all of animation. It was The Art of Disney, I think.
The Art of Animation, Bob Thomas's book.
That one, yes.
Yeah. Which was a very good... and still is a very good, straightforward breakdown of how animated cartoons are made at the Disney studio. And it came out originally as a tie-in with Sleeping Beauty, which was released in 1959. And then Bob updated it like 20 years later. But that's all. So if you want to learn about Warner Brothers cartoons and who were these guys with names like Charles M. Jones and Robert Clampett,
right.
And I Freeling.
Right.
And what did that mean? I dot Freeling. What did that mean?
He's not to be confused with I dot Sparber.
That's right. That's right.
Story.
And also, as I often brag to people, usually as they're backing away, I learned Roman numerals from watching Popeye cartoons.
Yes.
When those deck doors would open and it would say MCMXXXVI, I knew it was a 1936 cartoon.
Obviously. Obviously.
Well, I mean, I love telling my story of meeting, of coming to meet Leonard, because it's the beginning of my life as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I was always a comic book freak. I went to the first Comic-Cons in the late 60s, early 70s. So I was involved with the community of people who were weird, who liked old comic books and even old cartoons. I met Chris Steinbrunner. He used to run movies at the original Phil Suling Comic-Cons. And so I knew there was a community, but it was like a secret community of people who really love this stuff. So one day, I mean, I love those Warner Brothers cartoons so much. And I was hunting for some kind of a reference. We had no internet. We had no Wikipedia. We had nothing. There were no books. I went to the library. Amazingly, this library had the great movie shorts. And I opened that book up and I went berserk, because it didn't have the cartoons, but it had the Little Rascals, the Three Stooges, Laurel and Hardy. It was like, and it had all the episodes. I hate using that term actually with this, but all the shorts and who directed them, a one line plot synopsis. I mean, the whole thing when it was released, I just ate that book up. I found your book on movie comedy teams. And then one fateful day, I guess it would be, you tell me, is it 1973? When did the Disney films come out? 73 or 4?
73.
That makes sense. So
it's 1973, to be very clear.
No, it made sense, because in 73, one day I was coming up out of the subway in Forest Hills, and there was waiting for a bus to go back to where I lived. And there was a bookstore there. And I'd be waiting around for this bus. And I turned around, looked at the bookstore, and in the window was, they would put the newest books, the Disney films. And I, by Leonard Maltin, author of the great movie shorts, was on the cover. And I'm like, that's the guy who wrote the book. Here's a book about Disney. And I went inside. I still remember this, everything about it. I went inside. I said, can I see that book? It was only in the window for some reason. It was like brand new. Brought it down. I opened it up. I was like, I was just in heaven. And I said, I'm going to look up Victory Through Air Power. Let's see what he says about that. And we have a whole chapter and describing it in detail. And I'm like, it was like $12. And I didn't have to. I was like, I've got to have this book. I can't leave without this book. Somehow, I don't know how, if I went home and came back, I got $12, bought that book, read that book cover to cover that night. I was totally in heaven. And then shortly after that, within a few months, I saw they had an ad in the paper in the Village Voice or something for the new school. Maybe I'm wrong about this. I don't know how I found out about the class, but it wasn't the auditorium class. It was the full tuition expensive class.
Yes. Originally, this was a credit course.
Yes.
So it was serious, you know, serious stuff, although still run on an informal basis, but it did cost more.
It cost like $125 or more, something like that, which was a lot. In those dollars was a lot more money. And for a guy who had a trouble finding $12 to buy that book that one day, this was astronomical, but it was one of those, I am going to this class. I have got to meet this guy. He's teaching a class about the history of animation. This is the thing I'm interested in. You know,
this is what led to Jerry's life of crime.
That's right.
It all can be traced back to that fateful day.
Oh man!
Well, I got the notion that there weren't that many people in the class, but I at the end of it, of course, is when I would approach you with my books, and I was like the only one who did. So I felt like I just felt that it was meant to be. That's where I felt like we could be friends, because I mean, whether we could or not, I had that feeling, because the other
people were best friends ever.
They were just taking this class for the credit, you know, and watching, you know, an easy credit. I was there for, you know, I had to talk to you, you know.
Well, after a year or a year and a half, the dean of my division suggested that we might attract more people if we made it a series.
Right.
A screening series rather than a credit course. And it was a wise move, because then we had a really good turnout consistently. And I did it for 9 years.
Yeah.
And
you'd still be doing it if you never moved.
That's right? True. That shoot was only my job and my sudden job in Los Angeles that brought it to a close. But
by the way, I'd like to bring up that story. Because from my point of view, I think we've talked about this, but one day I'm with my friend Andrew Lederer, who might be listening now that I mentioned this, and he's met me at my place. We're going to do something, Entertainment Tonight, which I watched regularly at that time. And I still remember tying my shoes, putting on my sneakers. We're going to go out and get something to eat or something. And the guy says, and coming up next, our new movie reviewer, Leonard Maltin. And both of us look at each other like, what? You know, and we wait. We sit there and we're waiting. And there you come on reviewing. I think it was Annie or something like that. I think my mind says it was Annie. I don't know. And the minute it was over, I called you up and you picked up. And I said, so you're on Entertainment Tonight now? And you were like surprised. You could, I am. And so you tell it from there. I don't know what happened.
Well, actually, you left a message on my answering machine.
As everyone else did.
But you were the only one who was lucid enough because Alice and I were in Columbus, Ohio at the Cinevent.
Oh, okay.
A Memorial Day weekend when that aired. And when we came back, we had all these messages from relatives I haven't heard from in ages. All sorts of people who had seen me on the show where they ran my audition tape without telling me. I've told that story many times before. But you were the one who was lucid enough to say, and they introduced you as their new movie reviewer.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're a detail person.
Which was a piece of information I was not privy to.
No.
That's it.
So it all stems from that. Anyway, the class, the animation class, became, if you want to use a high-tone term, became a mecca, or if you want to just say it the way it was, became a hangout.
Yes.
For all the lost boys.
I was going to say, be polite. Be polite now.
But that's my mom's description of all of it is so funny, because it's true. You all found each other.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that the Theodore Huff Society
mm-hmm.
was so big for you, mm-hmm. Daddy, you know, and what that meant, this was that. And a lot of you have stayed friends. I mean,
my first girlfriend, Nancy Johnson. I met her. She came to the class. That's how we met. And
it really
and many
is.
Many
and,
other.
And of course, a lot of people who wound up working prominently in the animation world. Eric Goldberg, the incredibly talented animator and animation director. He animated The Genie in Aladdin. Eric has incredible credits, and he's a great guy. He came to that class.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Cito,
yes.
who has taught animation for many years and even ran the animation department for a while at USC.
And a big part of ASIFA.
And the head of the union, the local of the cartoonist union.
Which, by the way, I still think is the great... It sounds made up, the cartoonist union. It sounds like something that you would put into a cartoon.
It was called, they did change the name to the Animation Guild to be
the
accurate. But I prefer
cartoonist union.
It was called the cartoonist union.
And Ed Catmull.
I was going to say, it's a who's who. Yeah.
Who ran Pixar for many years.
Oh, that guy.
All sorts of people came in and out of that class.
Well,
goodness.
Yeah, we can go on for a long time, but of course, Drew Friedman and of course, Will Friedwald and on and on and on. Just, you know.
That's what I mean. Truly, some of the most important people still in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's mind blowing.
Absolutely.
But Jerry, as I said to you before we started, the thing about you and my dad is you know everything about each other. The goal is to talk a little bit about the stuff people don't know.
Well, I have here, this won't work in an audio medium. But I have a sheaf of loose leaf paper torn into confetti edges from one of those tightly spiraled bound loose leaf books on which Jerry wrote the information he was going to give me for the filmographies in my book of Mice and Magic. We became close friends, and you started doing very extensive and diligent research. Anyway, I wound up hiring Jerry to, you know, provide this vital information.
Let me see.
Which he, you know, which he did.
Oh my God.
at my behest, and people are still consulting the book for those facts.
When we post this episode, I will include this picture on the different, so you guys can see some
of this. Page or two.
Oh my God.
A page or two will do. The whole thing was handwritten.
No, Jerry, the whole thing. This entire packet.
Please do the whole thing. I mean, people will be fascinated with that. No, I worked took forever to do that. And
wow.
And years. In fact, I still remember that. I always remembered that you handed the book in. I still remember being at your place with the manuscript, and it was huge. It was like a giant pile, manuscript, and you were boxing it up, and I don't know what messenger service or how you were getting it to the publisher, but
Mafia, just a giant truck.
And I still remember that was 1 year before it came out, because obviously within that year they made galleys and corrections and typesetting, and it was a different universe than the way they made books. But I remember that the book was finished 1 year before it was published. So that would be 79. And I know that we were working on it for like at least 2 to 3 or 4 years in my mind's eye. There was that much. And I would, I came over a lot during that period. We went out on interviews to different places. I still remember visiting with Tom Nitel in particular and others. I also remember my favorite day was the day we went up to the upstairs of Willoughby Peerless. I had only done this that one time with you, but I think you were there before or knew the people really well. And we went upstairs and we looked at the mound of Terry tunes that they had there that we could pull any title we wanted out and watch anything we wanted.
Willoughby Peerless was an old, very established camera store. You could look up in Wikipedia what a camera store is if you don't know. But there used to be, along with record stores.
Right, right.
There used to be something called camera stores. And Willoughby Peerless, which indicates it was two companies that merged, or two stores that merged at some point, was the brand name in New York City. That's the ultimate store you went to. And they had a division that rented 16-millimeter films and sold prints right there
It should be mentioned the pilgrimage by the universe of collectors on President's Day weekend. I think it was Washington Day's birthday, where they sold, they had some kind of a sale on Washington's birthday. So you can go there and get a Terry tune for $5, and wow. I think I'm selling features. And so like everybody in town showed up for that.
Yeah.
They also sold Film Fan Monthly there.
Yes, they did. And the thing about it is that it was affordable. You could become a film collector in those days because it was not an extravagance.
Right.
I mean, the projector maybe cost between $100 and $150. It took time to save up, that amount of money. But then you could buy shorts and cartoons for $5, $10.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then trade with friends and find out about other sources and... oh my! Again, see, we could get lost in the mist of all this nostalgia, but it really was a different era. I mean, the idea that now you could sit at your computer and call up not everything, but almost everything
right. That
took us years and great pains,
and phone calls and letters,
right,
going across countries and nations to find. Oh, absolutely! Mm-hmm.
I mean,
Jerry,
yes,
what got you into this? First, tell me, where did you grow up? Tell me.
I grew up in Queens, and I grew up in Queens. I lived in a couple of different parts of it, but mainly Flushing, Kew Garden Hills near the World's Fair. I was like 8, 9, and 10 when the 1964 World's Fair, and I could literally walk to it. That's how cool. That's how close I was. I grew up in that area. I was a comic book geek from at least age 8, 9, 10, something like that, and wanted to draw and wanted to be a cartoonist. I thought that was, I didn't know what the future was, but I thought that would be a cool way to make a living. Somewhere in my teenage years, I got into cartoons because I love film. I also love film. And I thought animation was the perfect blend of filmmaking and drawing. So that's the perfect thing. And then I started, as a teenager, coming home from school, working on homework, I'd have Casper followed by Bugs Bunny would be on Channel 5. And Casper cartoons, they were there. But then I noticed that the ones that came on later, Bugs Bunny, were hilarious. And I'm a teenager, and I've seen these all my whole life, but I'm suddenly getting the jokes. I'm suddenly realizing, and then I'm looking at them like, how do they do that? How do they make a character move? How do they match it to the mouths? Like, I couldn't figure out how they even would do this sort of thing. So I got into that. And at one point, a cartoon came on, and on Saturday morning, I remember this, and it was on the Bugs Bunny show. And it was the one about the cat is being bullied by a bulldog, and he's always going, not happy birthday, not happy birthday. And the dog would pull him into some crazy Rube Goldberg contraption. Anyway, it's a crazy cartoon. It was on the Bugs Bunny thing. And I'm like, oh, I love this cartoon. I've seen this one before. What's the name of it? And that epiphany came over me. Where am I going to find out the name of that cartoon? How am I ever going to learn this? This is what led me to the library. This is what led me to try to find out what this was. I eventually actually remember finding the Film Fan Monthly issue where you listed every Warner Brothers cartoon title by year, but with no other information. So there was really still no other way to figure out what cartoon that was, even if I eventually found it out. Because I literally, that's where I started my cartoon research. I would watch Bugs Bunny. I said, I know it was on already. It's going to be on again. I'm going to watch every one. I'm going to write down the title and what that one was about. And eventually I'm going to hit it. And I did. It's a Robert McKimson cartoon called It's Hummer Time, which if I knew that title, I would never know that was the cartoon that was that plot. So sure. That really got me into wanting to connect the plots together. And I remember from my point of view that after meeting you and probably being polite for a while, I really remember asking you, why aren't you doing a book like the great movie shorts, but for the cartoons? And you were teaching a class about it. And that really didn't make any sense because you should have done a book like that. And I remember your answer was something about that we were all waiting for Mike Barrier to do his book because he had announced that he was doing a book and as if it were going to come out any moment. And so we kind of were waiting for that. But I think at one point you had on your own decided that there is no reason why I shouldn't do one. It might have been like a year or two later. You said, maybe I should. And that's when we talked about it. And that was the beginning of Mice and Magic.
That's all true. That is all true. And it was, again, I had the same kind of curiosity you did. Just to find out the basics.
Yeah.
And Mike Barrier is a guy who published a magazine called Funny World, which was about both animation and comic art. And he published an interview with Bob Clampett that was kind of like the Rosetta Stone. It was like uncovering the Dead Sea Scrolls. There was so much information in this one interview about one man's career that opened doors, revealed secrets, not secrets to him, but, you know, unknown to us. And it was, you know, you could hear a heavenly chorus singing as you turned the page. It's like, oh, that's what that is. That's right. How that came about. Mm-hmm. And then we were off and running. And the guys who did all those cartoons got no press coverage, no recognition at all, which is why they were doubly happy to greet geeks like us.
Sure.
I mean, we were the first generation where those cartoons were rerun and rerun. I mean, even when they were made, even though they were popular, people only saw them one off at the theater, or maybe there'd be a little compilation, but there was no fandom for them at that time. There was no, you know, organized, you know, fan interest. Occasionally a writer somewhere here and there would write an article about how I really like these cartoons, that kind of an article, you know. And also they were still alive. Most of them were still alive and kicking and doing new things, you know,
in the 70s. Yeah.
So, you know, it just took people like the fans. It took Mike Barrier. It took people like us to go and interview them, you know.
Now, just to show how far, or perhaps how little we've come in these 40-odd years since, Jerry is still doing commentary tracks for the DVD and Blu-ray release of the Pink Panther cartoons and the other DePatty Freleng Studio cartoons, which are coming out from Kino Lorber. And on his cartoon research site, he recently published an article by our mutual friend Keith Scott, who's a very talented Aussie and who is a demon researcher about cartoon voices, which is what he does for a living.
And he's great.
And he's fantastic.
He's great.
Well, Warner Home Video, Warner Archive, recently issued a terrific Blu-ray collection of Tex Avery cartoons. And no one got voice credit on screen for those shorts. So Keith has spent years, I don't know how much sweat he's put into this project.
Inevitably.
But he wrote a terrific article that Jerry published at cartoonresearch.com about who were all those voices.
Right.
The voice of Red Hot Riding Hood, the voice of the wolf, the, you know, the sex crazy wolf.
And while the answer is almost always June Foray, there are others that do. It's mind blowing, especially to anybody my age where we've grown up with credits that now credits can last 10 minutes. It's nuts. I don't remember which Harry Potter it was, but I remember that the first thing people talked about was that I think the credits were 8 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And that was, at the time, one of the longest running credits.
I remember Star Wars came out and we thought that was the longest credits. But you look back at it now, the original Star Wars.
It's quick.
It's nothing. But yeah.
But that's it. But if people didn't know, if people didn't watch, I mean, I watched what you guys watched growing up because my dad is my dad. So I was used to just there being those two slides. You know, where it said usually the director, the studio, basics, and maybe someone's name, maybe, but half the time not even. And the same thing with watching movies. There might be something at the beginning, and at the end there may be one or two that would show you the actors, but really that was it. So to think that the amount of work that you guys had to do to find this stuff.
Yeah.
It was tough. Actually, it was tough, but it was, to me, it's never ended. That's the interesting thing. That's why I love the Cartoon Research site. I almost feel like it's an Of Mice and Magic site. It just continues. There seems to be something new to discover almost every single day. And throughout the decades, I remember when Of Mice and Magic came out, we actually thought on, and I'm not saying we, I mean, of people I knew, a lot of friends, we all thought, that's it. History of animation, done. Got it. And I remember, and then little things would keep popping up, and it's 40 years later, and it's there's still new wonderful things to discover, and doesn't diminish anything about our love of these great classic movies, is the way I like to think of them. I wish Warner Brothers
now
thought of them like that.
Well. But now it's easier now for you guys to get to each other, you know,
yes.
like Keith being in Australia.
Right.
You know, there was a time when that conversation would be a lot harder. And now, thankfully.
Yeah.
Right.
Although somehow we got by with snail mail.
You did.
We didn't call it back then. We called it mail.
Mail.
Right. Well, you know, it's like once in a while I talk to my students, they wonder, how did you do certain things? I'm like, you know, it really wasn't that different. It's just we had different methods and they were slower. But we do everything we're doing now. We're just doing it a lot faster. And, you know.
Anyway. As you mentioned students. Right now, you are teaching three separate courses. elaborate, please.
Well, I'm even teaching more than three. I'm actually teaching two courses, but in five different schools. But I'm at teaching animation history at Woodbury University, which is a wonderful small campus here in Burbank, which, believe it or not, I can't exactly give you a name of a film, but it's used constantly in TV and movies as a college campus setting. There's so much filming on this
very
school.
Funny.
They're always giving us alerts about, you know, don't walk by the main thing. And I'm only, every once in a while, I'll see a TV show. And go, oh my God, there's Woodbury. It's, you know, in Riverdale, you know, but Woodbury is a little school and they have a great animation program as seemingly every school has now. I also got asked to teach at CalArts. I'm very proud of that. And I teach there both the history of animation and a class about the history of Disney. And that's pretty cool. And then recently I've got asked to teach at UCLA and some schools out of town because of the pandemic, because of remote teaching.
Yeah.
I got some friends of mine who were, one of which is at Laguna. I think it's Laguna State. I forgot the name of the school, but I'm going to be teaching there in a few weeks. I'm also teaching in a school in Tennessee. Don't ask. A friend of mine moved to Tennessee. He's in charge of their arts program. And why not? Call me up and let's do it online.
Sure. Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
I love it.
Next semester, Minsk.
Wait, say it again.
Next semester, you'll be teaching in Minsk.
Yes.
Oh, yes. I thought you were talking about teaching Charles Mintz or about Charles Mintz. That's what I thought.
And that's another thing entirely.
Yes.
Now, Jerry,
a history of animation from the point of view of the guy who stole Oswald from Disney.
That's right. Now, you've also far surpassed me in the sheer number of books you have to your credit.
Oh, I don't think so.
Well,
I
mean, rattle off a few titles for me.
I'll rattle off a few titles, but I think my total is in the universe of 15. There's a reason why I say that.
Jerry.
I'm sure you've done more than 15 books, right?
Yeah, but
the
movie guide doesn't count. The movie guide's one book.
He's done more than,
again.
I know you've done more than 15. But let's see. I did one called The Animated Movie Guide. That's a guide a la, you know, it was actually, believe it or not, I actually patterned it after, you wouldn't guess, but it's the Our Gang book. I wanted a book like the Our Gang book, but just for all animated features, if that makes any sense. That isn't quite how it turned out, but that was the original intention. I've done books for, you know, the studios. Like I did a book on Nicktoons and a book on SpongeBob and a book on Pink Panther and a book on, I've done three or four on the Looney Tunes, like the 100 greatest Looney Tunes, of which you did the introduction. My guidebook, the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies, which is an expanded guide on each cartoon. And the Looney Tunes visual guide. I'm looking around to see I did a book on Hanna-Barbera. A book on Tweety, a book on Mike and Spike's festivals. I mean, you better stop me now, but the 50 greatest cartoons. So it goes on from there. I just, you know, that's what I did for a while.
But that's in terms of not, as I say, when you're growing up, you don't know what your parents' friends do. You know that they exist and that you love them, but that's it. I will never forget one of the first times that we went to Comic-Con and people reacting to Jerry and to Mark Evanier, and it was like nothing I'd ever seen, because I think even for you guys it was overwhelming. People were going, hi, I love you, hi. You know,
that's because of finally being on camera with those Looney Tunes Golden Collections, you know, and doing the audio commentaries and also being on the documentaries. So people began to, you know, figure out who I was. So, that's my little moment of fame. But having lunch with Leonard throughout the years, decades, and seeing people coming up to him and asking for his autograph, I, to be honest, didn't want that. I mean, it's like, I don't want to be that famous, you know, because it's very intruding. But your graciousness to everyone coming up to you taught me to be, I hope, like that. When I meet fans and people who care. I mean, Leonard's my mentor. I will say that, you know, so I look to how he handles something, how he writes or how he does it. And I copy it. No, and I take it. That's how you should do it, is the way I look at it. And
get out of here.
There you go.
Can't you see I'm eating lunch?
That's mommy. That's my brother.
But
that's, as I say, it's something that to me is really joyous. Is to see all of you guys doing what you love, and it now being something that I think you're hearing from people about how much it means.
Well, I'll tell you, just to finish up, I'll give you, or to bore the audience on more about me, but you asked about how I got into this.
Jerry,
and
the podcast is about you.
Oh, it's about me. I didn't realize that. No,
yeah.
I, um, when I finally had to get an actual job, and I did have some what I call real jobs, just, you know, clerk jobs on Wall Street and things, and my initial jobs. But in fact, that allowed me to do a lot of the cartoon research because for the book, because I had this crazy job where I had to work from 6 to 1 in the afternoon. But then I went from 2 o'clock. I was at the Lincoln Center Library researching, you know, animation. It was that was actually a great help for all of us. But
Let me interrupt just to say, just parenthetically, the Lincoln Center branch of the New York Public Library was our home away from home. Not just yours and mine, but anybody researching articles or books on any facet of show business were dependent upon that library and its helpful library staff to get us, get our paws on this stuff for the first time. And I'll always be grateful to that and to those folks.
Just a few years ago when I was in New York, about maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, I decided just to go, do one of those things where I retraced my steps. I wanted to go. I haven't been there in decades. It was exactly the same, which was wonderful. It was the same. I went up the escalator, went up to that performing arts library upstairs, the same desks and everything was the same. Even though we're in the digital age, you could still pull the volumes. It was a great nostalgic trip, but it was... Anybody doing that or going there now, well, not now literally, but now it's exactly the way it looked in the 1970s. It was really, really great. But I did end up at United Artists, thankfully. I wanted somehow to be involved in the movies or cartoons. And I ended up, and I got in there because of my experience at working with the computer room and the computers on Wall Street. I had a little bit of experience. I ended up at United Artists and first in their computer room, but then as soon as I was in there, I found my way to the 16mm department, you know, which is, you know, that was my real home. And as you know, Leonard, once again, coming to my rescue, I did a little cartoon catalog. Remember that? You wrote the intro for it.
Oh, yes. Leslie Cabarga did the artwork for the cover.
That's right. That's right. And then
Leslie Cabarga, the talented artist and author of The Fleischer Story.
Yes.
Another one of the fundamental books.
Yes.
In the
When we were talking before about what was around in the 70s, we should mention Leslie's book and Joe Adamson's Tex Avery, King of Cartoons, which you were an editor of, I believe.
Yep.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And those were the books. Those were it. That was before pre Mice and Magic. It was like, you know, the era before Mice and Magic. Very, very few things to research. So I was at UA and I had a little home there. I was in the movie biz. I was able to work with cartoons and other things and film in general. And so I was very, very happy. And then Leonard went to California and that was sad. And then luckily I was able to follow. Thanks to Gary Meyer and Terry Thorne and the people at, and Steve Galula, who today is the head of Fox Searchlight. They were the people running Landmark Theaters, and they started Expanded Entertainment. That was a little company to distribute the Tournée of Animation, a festival of animation to theaters around the country. And they recruited me to work for them. And that was my entree to come to L.A. and have a job when I got here. And of course, I wanted to come to L.A. And I had Leonard and my friend Mark Kausler are the two people I knew out here. And so that's the beginning. And then you were born. So that brings us right up. That brings us right up to Jesse.
Yeah. Now let's not skip over the fact that you had another life for a little while as a film distributor.
That's right.
Specializing in anime, Japanese animated features.
I know.
You were kind of ahead of the curve there.
Yeah.
I blow the minds of my students when I talk about my experiences with Akira. I have an interesting story about that, about Akira. That's kind of a happy ending to something that just happened recently. So I'll quickly tell you that. Yeah, because of my film distribution background, having worked at United Artists, I worked for Orion Classics, and then I was distributing these movies with Landmark Theaters. I had the Rolodex and the knowledge of, I had all inside me of film distribution and how to do that. And of course, I was interested in distributing, I was interested in distributing Japanese anime. No one was doing it. This is the the 80s, late 80s. No one was doing it. The very few people who were doing it, like Roger Corman, they would take a Miyazaki film, a film called Nausicaa and the Valley of the Wind, and the he dubbed it very, very badly and chopped it to 88 minutes so it would fit in one film can. And that was what anime was to anybody seeing it. And they dubbed it so horribly. So I got together with a partner, and we knew enough. We knew we had enough connections. We knew who to go to. And we were able to make an easy arrangements to distribute Castle in the Sky. The Miyazaki film was our first film. And we didn't, Akira was like the third, because no one in Hollywood wanted these things. No one, DVDs didn't exist, and no VHS distributors. Nobody wanted these movies. And so, but we knew there was an audience for them. I had gone to Comic-Con forever, so I knew there was a sub-cult underground for anime. And I thought it was worth, these were good enough to show the public. And so that was a really, that was a whole experience. That could be a whole show unto itself, but that was quite an experience. I'll tell you this quick story, though, which hopefully your audience will appreciate. One day, while doing Streamline Pictures, I was talking to my partner, Carl, and I said, you know, we have our poster on the wall. You know, we should act like a real distributor. Why don't we go out? Why don't we see if we can get a sell? Imagine if we called up, you know, and the people who are distributing in Japan, Akira, and said, can we get a sell? Can we ask? I mean, we're just the American distributor. Could we happen? We just want to put it on our wall to display it. And they actually, they said, we're about to dump the entire warehouse of these. We're getting rid of them, but maybe we can pull one out for you. I said, well, what do you mean you're going to dump it? And we were on the phone frantically. We said, well, what would it cost if you sent it to us? And so for a very reasonable amount of money, a lot of money, but a reasonable amount, they, instead of throwing it out, they put it on a slow boat to our address and sent it to us. And 8 months later, something like that, we got a call one day, and I pick up the phone, and it's the port of LA, and and I'm like, I never heard from the port before, but we've got like six skids of boxes here for me from Japan. I'm like, what? Like, what? Oh my God, it must be the Akira artwork. And I had to find out everything about customs and manifests and getting this material, and had to get it dropped in front. I've got stories about that. We had all this Akira artwork, and we ended up having a sideline of selling it to, animation galleries and things. Anyway, that was the past. I never even kept a piece of the artwork. Decades later, last year, a major anime collector called me up, and apparently it turned out he bought a lot of this artwork throughout the years. He bought the key pieces, and he started having gallery shows around the world of the Akira artwork. I didn't even know about this. He was also written up, and there was a story on CNN, which is online, about him and his collection and all this. And he showed it to me, and he said, I know the story, and I know that you guys brought this stuff over here, and I know everything about it. And he goes, and now I'm done with this material. I have done what I wanted. I love this film so much. I just want to, I hear you're part of ASIFA. I want to donate it intact. I don't want to split it up. I don't want to sell it. I just want to donate it where it'll be loved and kept and cherished. And I said, well, and what I did was ASIFA really has gotten, we don't hold anything anymore, but we do take in contributions for our archive, but we have entered into an arrangement with the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So I called the Academy, and we had, and a long story short, we had that collection is now in the Academy's collection. And I'm very proud of that.
Should be.
And if that's, anyway, that's the end. That's to well, me but I mean, the but end it's, of the you story. Know,
but it was quite an adventure, because I remember when you were going through it, and your belief in the audience for anime was really groundbreaking, because you knew people were out there. And though this was not on anybody's mainstream radar, the mainstream media had no clue. And but when you would open in Minneapolis, people showed up.
Right.
People showed up.
The theaters, because my main knowledge was the art theaters, you know, because we were looking, you know, from Orion Classics and UA Classics. So I knew the theater owners and stuff, and they were reluctant to book it. Then they would book it, and they would call me up later. And I go, they were just amazed, because I remember one of them told me, I wish I remember who exactly, said, "It's not our audience, but it's an audience," you know, and, and that's all that matters, you know, when you're owning a theater and you're, you know,
is
that people show up. So they were very happy with us. They were very pleased, and we were able to make some kind of a business out of it. And I'm very proud of that experience. After about 5 years, I moved on and ended up working for ultimately for Nickelodeon Movies. It was the beginning of that. And I worked for a lot of the different companies, and that's it. That's my life. There it is. No, and I've always done like three or four things early on. Here's a tale for the young ones. But but early on, before I was even involved with United Artists, and I was working in the Wall Street area and these little dinky, just to have a job. And I got fired from one of them for no reason. They were firing people. But for me, it was traumatic. It's like I didn't have another job lined up. I had nothing else going on. And I had one of those epiphany moments. This will never happen to me again. One of those Gone with the Wind moments. And so I've always been somebody who has 2, 3, 5, 6 things going on at the same time, because I couldn't rely on, I learned early not to rely on one benefactor, one job. I had to have something else going on. So if something happened with this job, I had this other situation going on. That's just me. That's the way I've been. So
when you were doing the streamlined business with Carl Masick,
yes,
and it was just the two of you,
yes,
distributing, just, was it more than one film at a time?
Oh yeah. Well, it was one film at a time, but yeah, but a year into it and more, you have like 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah. You know, yeah. But I mean, you learned how to operate on not just low overhead,
no overhead.
Right. And I had a very weird experience in that way. I first worked for United Artists Classics. There's like 10 people. Then I worked for Orion Classics. I think it was less than 10. John Agiolotti, who's a big producer now, was one of the people we worked. It was like 6 of us. Then I got recruited to work for Terry Thorne in an office of 4 people. They're doing the same thing, distributing movies to these theaters. And so distributing a movie with Carl, we basically broke it down. I mean, I was the physical distributor talking to the theaters, but we had to do everything. Carl was the production guy. He would ready the movies in English. I was a production assistant. He was the main guy on that. We both worked on the posters and created the press kits and stills. And we were like a one man or two man movie company. And it was cool. Because I love the movies like you do. I love going to the movies. When we were kids, you approach the theater and there's the marquee. Well, even before that, you'd see the ad in the paper. Then you'd come to the theater and see the marquee, and then you'd get closer and you'd see the poster and stills outside the movie. Remember that? That disappeared early. And then you might see a standee, you might see some other thing, and then, of course, the coming attractions in the movie. But it was a different experience that people today, the last 20 years at least, don't know. They just go to the movies. There might be a poster outside. I was telling somebody a few years ago that the only thing left from the days when we went to the movies was the physical poster. And even a lot of movie theaters today don't have a physical poster. It's like a video screen.
I know. And yet there's been a return of the standee.
Yes.
That's true. Yes.
That's an oddity that,
but this is the thing, is that because, as we know, everything is cyclical, because of the internet being the way it is, with something like Instagram or Twitter, people take pictures with things.
Right.
So now, where you've had things like that, where people get rid of everything that exists in real life, you can't take a picture with nothing. So they've gone back to doing what was around when I was a kid, where you can sit in and it looks like you're part of a poster. Right. You put your face through. Who would have thought that those things at beachside towns, mm-hmm. you know, where you stick your face through, would still be so popular, something so simple? But again, how else are you meant to do something? In the same way that they've now brought back, in some cases, like for some of the scary movies like It, they'll do a temporary haunted house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the stuff, the theatrics. are coming back because.
Well, speaking of coming back, in the news lately, they rescinded the Paramount consent decree.
That's right.
And the
that's the landmark case.
Say it again.
That was the landmark case that where the government said you can't own both a movie studio distributing films and movie theaters showing them. And that's when Paramount had to divest itself of Paramount Theaters.
Yeah.
And RKO, which was a big studio, had to divest itself of the RKO theaters and Fox, all of those. And,
well,
and
I would love to see the, I know it's, I don't know what I'm thinking here, but I think it would be cool if the movie studios ran the theaters. And obviously they've been lax about that law in recent years, thus Netflix buying the Paris and the Egyptian and the, and I don't know what the arrangement is with Disney and the El Capitan, but clearly Disney controls the theater, it seems to me.
Yes.
And they also restored it. And I think Netflix is going to restore the two theaters as well. That they have. And look, I mean, if we love movie going, I actually think that the potential for good things might happen out of this. You know, I think theaters might actually improve. That's what I think.
Well, something like the El Capitan, I always tell people, especially friends with kids, it is, again, something that goes back.
It's showmanship.
Back to an experience. Yeah.
It's a retro, let's call it a retro brand of showmanship.
And a lot of the people who work there have worked there for years. They really care. They're excited, especially for kids, but just in general.
You know, El Capitan, we should explain for non-Angelinos.
Yes.
Is a beautiful theater. Gorgeous. Originally built in 1927. It's on Hollywood Boulevard.
It's across the street from the Chinese theater.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right across the street from the Chinese. And it is beautiful on the outside, beautiful on the inside. And they do things like they have an organist because they have this fantastic organ inside the theater. So he's playing when you come in. There is a show, as you say, a spectacle.
They have that curtain opening.
Even if they don't have the Mighty Wurlitzer going, they still have those multiple beautiful curtains.
And occasionally they'll have, depends on the movie. I haven't really gone to any of these, like Toy Story. They'll have some sort of little wacky Toy Story thing with people in costume. I don't know if, Leonard, did you go to this? I don't know anybody who remembers this, but the first week or so when the El Capitan reopened this way, the movie was The Rocketeer. Mm-hmm. And this stays in my mind, and yet I know no one who remembers it. You went in, and they had ushers in the costume. I think they still do this. They have the people in the uniforms, like usherettes. And
yes, they still do.
Right? And they had them. They took your ticket, and they'd lead you to a seat or whatever. And then I recall, it may have only been a week or two that they did this, the ushers suddenly... the music started playing and they went into that opening number from A Day in Hollywood, A Night in the Ukraine. You know?
Oh, yes, I do remember that.
Do you remember this? Because I know nobody remembers this. And I thought it was the coolest thing in the world to see.
And they used the boxes, the old fashioned opera style boxes on the second level of the auditorium. I mean, it was, they don't really have much of a stage there, so they can't very much.
But they do what they can
but
do.
But they imagination goes a long way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And by the way, when we were talking about how it's across the street from the Chinese, we probably should have said it's next door to the Jimmy Kimmel Theater.
Yes.
No, it's across from the Chinese.
Okay. Well, just for the younger people who might.
Yes.
No, of course. Yes. No, it's right on Hollywood Boulevard. There's so much there. I realize that the other thing we have to, before we finish, we have to talk about Cartoon Dump.
Well,
what you used to
we can talk about it, but it's in the past now. We don't.
Yeah, but
have
it was
that.
Still, Jerry. You have to give yourself some credit for the stuff that you've done that meant a lot to people.
Well, and Leonard's been on Mystery Science Theater and referred to a lot on Mystery Science Theater. I'm a big Mystery Science Theater 3000 fan, and through various machinations and things I've done in my universe, in my life, I got to meet the main people like Joel Hodgson and Frank Conniff, TV's Frank on that show. And me and Frank became very good friends, actually. And he's a big film buff. He is a huge Leonard Maltin fan and a giant film buff. And he's now in New York, and he's been in New York for a while, for the last few years. But when I had done up until this year, because of reasons we can't do it this year, I had done for about 15, 16, 17 years a show at the Comic-Con called The Worst Cartoons Ever. And that was very successful. And Frank, who had come and seen me do that, came up with this idea that what if we took that idea and made it into a show about the worst kitty show in the universe that's hosted by, you know, a guy who's just a drunk, and the show takes place in a back alley and it's a dump. And he came up with this premise, and I would show the cartoons, and I would even come out and talk about the cartoons, and came up with this idea for a show that would also showcase his friends, other comedians. And we ended up mounting this thing at the Steve Allen Theater in Hollywood. And it was a gigantic success initially. And the guy wanted us to keep doing it every month. And we ended up doing it for like 5 or 6 years. And we had people like Maria Bamford and Patton Oswalt and so many, many people who went on to become very famous would just come and hang and tell jokes during it and be part of our little show. But it was a thing that we did. I'm very proud of it. We recorded a few of them, and it's, you know, Frank went back to New York to work for a couple of years, and he's still there. And we every once in a while we talk about, you know, if we can figure out, you know, pitching it to somebody, maybe, or reviving it somehow, we will. Maybe we will, maybe we never will, but it was a thing we did, and it worked for a while.
If somebody smart and enterprising listening to this right now,
it's available.
Looking for a good idea. you just heard it. So act accordingly.
And we now, had sets and costumes and things. I don't know, Jesse, did you ever come to one of them?
Yeah.
You did. Oh, okay. Because you said we had a big dumpster set, and we had costumes on everybody, and it was a real show. You know, we really did something. So, yeah.
Well, it lives on in memory.
It does.
And fond memory. So we should reveal, not that it's a secret, what we were doing just before we pressed the record button, before Aristotle, our engineer, pressed the record button. We were both delighting in the issue of Bugs Bunny stamps by the U.S. Postal Service.
Yes.
Which I didn't know about yet.
They just came out, they're pretty darn good. They're obviously, this is the year of Bugs Bunny's 80th birthday. And I don't know how many people knew, but for like 30 years, maybe it's 20, the studio, Warner Brothers, would not allow anybody to use dates. They didn't want to have any anniversaries. This was shortly after my first books came out, where we had release dates in them. If you really look back at these books now, and a lot of things we did on video, they would edit out, you know, oh, this came out in 1941, or they did not want anybody to know when these cartoons were made. They didn't want anybody to think of them as old. They were afraid of anybody getting a wise idea if any of them were to somehow go into public domain someday. That's what they were spooked about. So about a year or so ago, somebody inside the company said, why are we doing this? And they lifted that. So the minute they lifted that, somebody realized that it's Bugs Bunny's birthday, this year. And they've gone all out to celebrate that in many, many different ways.
We were on a virtual panel at the virtual San Diego Comic-Con weeks ago, celebrating Bugs' 80th birthday.
Exactly. And so this new one, they went to their, I don't know who they went to exactly, whether it's the new crew doing those wonderful new Looney Tunes, or if it's Tony Cervone and Spike Brandt, who have been their mainstays, who worked on Space Jam and Back in Action and really know the characters well. But they did a really, really good job recreating about, let's see, it looks like 10 scenes from classic Bugs Bunny moments. Barber of Seville, Rabbit of Seville, Super Rabbit, Baseball Bugs, Rhapsody Rabbit, and Opera Doc is mentioned here. Of course, that's one of two where Bugs is in drag, which, you know, says it
gotta
all.
Gotta love.
And so these stamps are now available And Jesse's already ordered a couple of sets for us.
I have.
One to use, one to save.
Forever.
Yes. I think they're savable. Definitely savable.
So hooray for the struggling U.S. Postal Service.
Yes.
Maybe this will put them over the top financially.
I was thinking that. Maybe Bugs Bunny will save the post office.
Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be a lovely turn of events? Well, Jerry, thanks so much for giving us some of your time, which is taken up by teaching or spreading the gospel, let's say, to students.
Happy to do it anytime. Next time we should talk more about cartoons.
Well, actually, that is something we've, as I talked to you about the first time I've been doing this, I sort of want us to do a series on our show because so many people have questions. So we did a part one. We talked generally about the cartoons. Then we had your pal Mark Evanier on. Now we'll have you. So perhaps we can get nerdy, get you guys all together.
That would be fun. And, yeah.
That's,
go that, a
that,
little deeper.
Always,
that might be,
always
that might be a force field it. That would, that might be a too much power.
An epic nerd force field.
Yes.
The animation force field. Well, I should, so people can follow you on social media.
I'm on Facebook.
Yeah. And Twitter.
And Twitter, yes.
And I should say for anybody, the Facebook group for Cartoon Research is wonderful. People love it, and it is a whole community. People post stuff all the time. I really recommend it. You will find kindred souls there who you can geek out about stuff like Bugs Bunny stamps with.
I also say that I'm doing that other news site, but quite frankly, 9 times out of 10, there's the latest bits of news about what's going on in animation. It's pretty much on that Facebook page.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because the fans will just put on that news right away. So,
yep. Yeah. I recommend it highly. You can find it on Facebook, Cartoon Research. Yeah.
Well, Jerry, great to talk to you. We're doing this via Zoom.
Which is no fun.
Which is frustrating, but it's still nice to see you.
Yes.
And as always, and keep up the great work.
Thank you.
And let's touch base soon.
You say that like the second we're off this, the two of you won't be on the phone.
No.
5 minutes later.
I'm going to be going to buy a new phone the minute we hang up. But yeah.
And for us, Jesse, where do people locate us?
You are at Leonard Maltin and I am at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. And you are on Facebook. You can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And we are on Patreon.
The Maltrion clan.
And we are very grateful to all the people who have been kind and generous enough to support what we do. That's at patreon.com/MaltinOnMovies. patreon.com/MaltinOnMovies. And thank you very much. So that's all till next time. I won't say that's all, folks.
How could you not say that's all, folks?
Well, because
if there was ever a time to say that's all, folks.
That's all, folks.
Thank you.
Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.